my name is Bernadette Russell. Welcome to episode 18 of my podcast, How to Be Hopeful, a podcast all about hope, how to find it and how to keep hold of it once you've found it. This week I'm very pleased to be talking to Chris Williams, a friend of mine who is currently living in Beirut with his partner Gemma. As most of you will know, on the 4th of August there was a terrible explosion in Beirut which caused great suffering and loss. And Chris talks to us about his experience of the explosion and what he witnessed and how hope can be found even in the midst of terrible disaster. Thank you for listening. Here he is. Is that better? If my video...
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think so.
Do you know, hopefully, yeah, hopefully it'll be mostly you, so that's okay. How are you? How are you doing today, you and Gemma?
Yeah, we're okay. Okay, it's been kind of strange few days. So yeah, we're feeling all right.
Yeah.
Given the circumstances.
Yeah, very extreme circumstances. So obviously you're living in Beirut, and it'd be great to have a conversation with you about recent tragic events there, but just for context, would you mind just telling us how you ended up in Beirut and what you've been doing there since you arrived and since you've been living there?
Yeah, sure. We've been here since October, and we've been feeling like this for a while, but we wanted to have a little bit of an adventure and to go somewhere, to live abroad for a little while. We wanted to go somewhere that was quite different from the UK, but also somewhere where the things that we enjoy are still there. So really great food and bars and nightlife and, you know, lots of fun things to do, going to the sea, going to the mountains. And we looked at lots of different places, but Beirut and Lebanon just really, really ticked the boxes for us. And we're really lucky that we both do a lot of freelance work, so we can kind of do that from anywhere, really. So we've been still working for in jobs in the UK, but out here, which was a lot easier. We thought that might be really difficult. We were worried about it, but actually, especially over the last few months during coronavirus, everybody's meetings and everything have been via Skype or FaceTime or whatever anyway, so actually now everybody else is in the same boat as us, working remotely from home. So
that's sort of made it the usual experience, hasn't it? Which is good,
it's quite strange.
So Chris, what have you and your partner Gemma been, what kind of work have you been doing remotely from Beirut in the UK?
So Gemma works in fundraising for charities. A lot of her work now is actually in conservation and wildlife and environment charities. So she does a lot of the fundraising work for freelance clients for different charities. And then I co-run a theatre company and charity in the UK as well. There's two of us as directors. So the other director, Sheena, was kind of running things on the ground in the UK. And then I was doing all of the sort of the boring fundraising and budgets and all of that kind of stuff. So I was quite lucky with that she was... And our trustees, our board of trustees as well, was sort of like, yeah, it's fine, you go off and deal with that remotely, and then Sheena's on the ground, running that kind of thing.
It's really inspiring to hear that you could make that bolder choice and that it worked. I think that's really really inspiring.
Yeah, and I think again with coronavirus, because people have not been able to go into the office and they've had to work from home, and actually people are seeing that work quite well. And I've heard from some people that they've kind of said, well, actually now when I have to have a meeting, I can just do it via Skype. I don't have to trek an hour across London to go and have that meeting.
Yeah.
And so I think people are suddenly realizing actually you don't have to be so tied to, you know, kind of going into an office every day, and you can work remotely quite easily. And that for me, that suddenly makes the world a much smaller, closer place.
Yeah, it kind of
makes sense.
No, it does. I agree. And it feels like the interconnectedness that is sort of revealed or exposed is of... are positive things, actually, that, you know, it's made us do things that now we're like, okay, we can do this, so it's easy. And, you know, it's more environmentally friendly, isn't it, not to be driving or getting on a bus somewhere. And
So that's all, of course.
So great. And so Beirut, which I know very little about, but just sounds amazing from your description. Mm. So as well as continuing, for you and Gemma, continuing your work in the UK, Have you sort of been getting up to stuff in Beirut, this amazing, lovely city with loads of exciting things going on?
Yeah. I mean, it's Lebanon as a country is just amazing because it's tiny. Like it's such a small country. Beirut's kind of sort of halfway up the country, and you know you can be right far in the south or right up in the north, you know, with like in an hour and a half. It's really easy to see the whole country, and the you know, everywhere is different. Each town or village that you go to is completely different from the last one. And the scenery is, you know, you can, from Beirut, you know, in less than an hour, you can be right up in the mountains where there's, you know, skiing in winter. Lebanese people love to ski. You know, there's certain times of the year, people always say that you can go skiing in the morning and then you can be on the beach in the afternoon. I mean, it depends. Depends how, you know, cold you're happy to be on the beach. You know, you could go for a swim, but the water would be pretty cold if you were at that time of the year.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, it sums up the country, really, that you can, there's so many different places to visit. And then Beirut is kind of, you know, itself very different to a lot of the country. It's got really amazing food, it's got fantastic nightlife and clubs. It's kind of got everything, really. And it's really, you know, everyone Lebanese people particularly always joke that Europeans love going to Beirut because it has this feeling of organized chaos. I kind of, you know, particularly like, you know, the roads are crazy, and there's a feeling of people kind of do what they want in Beirut. It's very free and easy, and it's such a great place to be in. And the overwhelming thing for me, I think, is that it doesn't matter who you are or where you've come from, the people here are so welcoming. In a way that sort of, particularly for British people, I think, we're kind of suspicious of it and taken aback. And I remember we were here in maybe our first week, and we were, I think we were walking to the supermarket or something like that. And it was early in the morning, and suddenly there's somebody shouting at us from a balcony. And we were kind of thinking, oh, are we somewhere we shouldn't be? Have we done something wrong? Who is this, you know? And then we suddenly realised that it was just some guy on his balcony who wanted us to go into his house to drink coffee with him and his wife.
Oh, my God, that's so amazing.
And we were like, we were so suspicious of it.
Yeah.
And then we went in and we sat for an hour and we had coffee and biscuits and chatted. And that kind of set the tone, really, for us, that that's just, you know, the Lebanese people, really, their sense of warmth and hospitality and being welcome is just very, very different to the UK, where we're kind of a bit more reserved, and you know,
that's so beautiful. And do you think Chris was he do you think he was sort of interested, was like, oh, they look like they're not from here, you know? Do you think it was a sort of interest in you? No, I mean in a positive way, sort of an interest in you.
Definitely. I mean, it's there's a On one hand, I think there's an inquisitiveness, you know, we're clearly not Lebanese, you know, Gemma's got blonde hair, we're clearly, you know, European. So there's that kind of inquisitiveness and wanting to chat to us and wanting to make sure that we feel welcome in their country. But then there's a sadness to that in a way, because certainly, you know, Lebanon in the past has had periods of being, you know, a real tourist destination.
Mm.
And it's got every, you know, it has so many things that make it a great tourist destination. But in recent times, that's, you know, they just haven't had the tourists come in here.
Yeah.
And I think that's something to do with the way that Lebanon is perceived in Europe, because of its history. And
it's interesting, isn't it? It feels like it's about stories again. It's about the stories we hear and what gets told and what gets shared. And it's why it's sort of really great to hear different versions of things, I think, which is beautiful. Because I found your Facebook post, which we'll come on to in a moment, just so beautifully written and also really moving. Before we go on, obviously that's lovely, but we obviously everybody that's listening will be aware that there was this terrible massive explosion in Beirut on the 4th of August, and I was just catching up with the details of which, of course, you're going to know a lot more and on the ground. But for those who are listening who might not be confident about the details, so the disaster was preceded by this enormous fire at the port of Beirut, and then around 6 p.m. the roof of the warehouse caught fire. The warehouse had been storing 2,000 tonnes of ammonium nitrate. So there's this initial explosion followed by a series of smaller blasts. And I think a lot of people witnessed that sounding like fireworks. And then we all saw this explosion, this mushroom cloud explosion and the supersonic blast. I mean, that was so shocking. And that is what caused, as far as I'm aware, a lot of the damage. So hospitals got overwhelmed. Yeah. As far as I'm aware, there is at least 158 people dead, 6,000 people injured, and 300,000 people homeless, which is, you know, those statistics are extraordinary. And a lot of anger because the ammonium nitrate, which caused that explosion, had been left in the warehouse for 6 years, despite all those.
Yeah.
So I know that you, obviously, that those are the sort of numbers, and I'm aware that you and Gemma and your cat were pretty close to the epicentre. Do you mind, if it's not too horrible for you to discuss it, could you just talk us a little bit about your experience as being so close to that? Because I know you mentioned the next 48 hours were grueling and the flat was destroyed. So if it's okay, could you talk us through your experience?
Yeah, there? Yeah. Yeah, of course. So fortunately, we're not in our apartment at the time. We were about 2 kilometres, I would guess, away from the port. We were actually taking Arabic lessons, which is incredibly difficult. it's a lot of fun, and it's a really interesting language, but it's really, really hard. So we were at an Arabic school about 2 kilometres. I'm not very good with estimating distances, but it's in, for anyone that knows Beirut, it's in a place called Sassin Square. And we were maybe halfway through the lesson, and suddenly there was a kind of shaking, I guess, which felt, to me, felt exactly like an earthquake, which I've only felt like a proper earthquake once before, and that was in Indonesia, and it was terrifying because it's such a weird feeling.
Yeah.
So it felt like a sort of a vibrating of the building and a heavy shaking.
Yeah.
But without any real sound initially, and that lasted maybe a second or 2 seconds, and the lights went out, which is quite normal in Beirut. We have quite a lot of power cuts, but particularly at the moment, the country, a lot of places are getting maybe 2 hours of electricity a day because of the economic situation. So, you know, there's all that this is on top of. So the lights going out wasn't a particularly surprising thing to happen. But then there was this, I would say probably two or three seconds, although it's, you know, kind of felt a bit slow motion, so it was difficult to tell. And then there was an incredibly loud bang or crashing sound, and followed by just the sound of glass shattering that sounded like it was coming from everywhere. Luckily, the room that we were in was a small room with kind of small, the window had very small panes and they didn't shatter. But our initial response was, because it's Beirut and because of its history, was that that it was a bomb, and that it felt very close to us. So we kind of jumped up, moved away from the windows, tried to listen to see if we could get a sense of what was going on. I went straight on Twitter, actually, because whilst it's not the most reliable source of information, it's, you know, you can often quickly find out if there's something going on. And because this sound had been heard throughout the entire city and even much further away, the reports were of multiple explosions, because we thought the explosion was where we were, so everybody else thought the same thing.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's these reports of different explosions everywhere. And it was only until after maybe 5 minutes that we started to get reports that it was one explosion. But, you know, our initial reaction as well was to call the UK embassy, and I managed to get through to them, but at this point they didn't know anything about it. They hadn't had any other reports, so they kind of just told us to stay where we were. And then we started to realise quite quickly that it was this one explosion at the port, and that it was kind of finished, I guess, in a way, that it wasn't, you know, like, it wasn't an attack or multiple bombings or anything, and that we could then go out onto the balcony of this building to take a look at what had happened. And every window that you could see was smashed out. The road was covered in glass. There were cars with, you know, things had fallen on the cars. And it was chaos, because a lot of the people who were out in the street didn't know what was going on yet. You know, people were frightened and panicked, and cars everywhere. And then once we realised that it was the port, we live maybe 600 metres from the port. So when you see on the news that the main couple of streets where the residential streets where the main damages to people's homes, that's basically where our apartment was. And we didn't know what the scale of damage was down there at that point. So we started walking towards it, and gradually the damage was getting worse and worse, and obviously lots of people injured. So at this point we started to realise that, you know, things were going to be bad once we got to our apartment. And luckily live in a building that's, there's lots of these type of apartment blocks in Beirut that are kind of relatively modern, but they're really solid concrete shells. So the buildings themselves didn't collapse or anything in the blast. A lot of the older buildings did. So we were able to get into our apartment block in relative safety. And as you mentioned before, at this point, our main concern was, you know, we've got lots of belongings in there, but our main concern was this cat that we were fostering, because there's this really amazing charity here called Animals Lebanon, and they rescue animals, mostly cats and dogs, and they try to rehome them, but if it's not a kitten, I think they find it a little bit more difficult to rehome them. So they foster them out. So we took this cat called Mouse, who'd had a bit of a tough time. I think he'd been hit by a car, and we don't know where he was before that. And then he was taken to a vet's, but they didn't know what to do with him. So they kept him in a cage in a basement for 3 months. So he, poor little guy, had a really tough time, but he came to us and lived with us for a while. And so our main concern at this point was to find him. And we went into the flat searched everywhere, and we couldn't find him. So we assumed that maybe he'd run away because it was scary. And when we went into the flat, the windows were all blown out and the window frames were all collapsed into the building. All of the doors, the front door, all the internal doors had been blown off. Lots of really surprising things, like the oven, which had been in the kitchen, had somehow been blown out of the kitchen door and was on the balcony.
Oh my God.
And the sofa was at the other side of the room. Like, lots of very heavy items were just like,
yeah, I mean, they're thrown around. They're seriously bulky things, aren't they? That's shocking.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a real mess. And at this point for us, you know, it's starting to get dark, and we didn't want to be in that building in the dark because obviously the electricity was gone. There was water dripping. You could kind of smell gas because not everything had been turned off by this point. So we just wanted to get out, grabbed the essentials, passports, things like that, and then left. But, you know, there's no like taxis or anything that can get in there. So we had this like really long, 45 minute, hour long walk through the rubble to get out. And there's, you know, you can imagine the kind of, I won't go into graphic detail, but you can imagine that there's lots of injured people, and it's lots of panicked people and scared people. And that was kind of the worst point of it, I guess. And, you know, we after we left, we suddenly realized that there was loads of stuff, loads of our belongings in there that we could have salvaged. And also we started to think that we thought Mouse the cat would probably go back there. So we decided we should go back there first thing the next day. And obviously didn't, you know, we didn't really want to go back. It was quite a, you know, upsetting to be there and all that kind of thing. But we went back there to salvage stuff. And I think this is, for me, is where, you know, I think I said this in the Facebook post that you mentioned earlier, that what I expected to be an upsetting trip back was actually really kind of heartwarming and moving, because the streets were just full of people who had just come straight there to help, you know, to do what they could. There's people bringing manouche, which is this Lebanese people love it. It's like the staple breakfast of Lebanon. It's like a kind of a flatbread pizza type thing with cheese or thyme on it. And there's just like hundreds of people with hundreds of these manouche, giving them out and giving bottles of water out and offering, you know, asking you if you need somewhere to stay, and if you're hurt, if you need to talk to somebody. And that, you know, as I said, that first feeling that we had when we moved to Lebanon of this kindness and warmth and welcoming, it was that, but kind of times 100, you know, that this, everybody pulling together in this like really, really bleak time for Lebanese people, that they're straight onto the streets to help people.
Yeah, that section of your Facebook post was so incredibly beautifully moving. But I have to say, Chris, as well, also really encouraging, because it's horrendous what you've all experienced, but on the outside of it, it's also really important to hear that, because it's encouraging. And I think actually it's really important, isn't it, for people to feel hopeful that actually people are looking out for each other, because otherwise it's just so bleak. So I'm really grateful for you for reporting that, and so pleased to hear that, and not surprised, I have to say, that was happening. And it does make people feel more hopeful that even at the absolute worst of times, people try to help each other. So that's a really good example to me of one of those stories I was talking about. Let's hear that as well. You know, let's not just hear the. So you made it back to the flat through that.
So my story is probably a little bit rambling, actually.
No, it's perfect. It's not at all. It's beautiful.
It's quite difficult to like remember like what days things have happened on.
Because
even now, I have absolutely no idea what day of the week is. It's so like, you know. So then we went, we made it back. We started kind of rooting through, trying to salvage things. We'd lost a lot of stuff, like my computer had sort of disappeared. We think it had been sucked out of the window or something like that, you know. But we started rooting through things, and then I was picking something up off the floor, and I happened to glance across under the sofa, and Mouse the cat was under there hiding.
Oh, that's great.
So I ran across, and I reached under and tried to give him a little stroke, and he meowed, and he blinked, and he looked, you know, like he was all right, I think, as he could be. He was terrified, obviously. So we straight away called Animals Lebanon, who have been doing this really amazing work for the last few days, with a big team of volunteers, you know, going into all of the buildings, looking for pets that have been lost, finding pets, reuniting them with their guardians. And so we called them straight away and just said, look, we've found him. We can't quite see if he's injured or anything, but he's terrified. We didn't have a cat carrier or anything, so we needed them to bring one. And they turned up, and they had been, I mean, they've got a big team, but two of them turned up. Both of them were kind of covered in sweat and dust, and they'd just come from another building that looked like it was about to collapse, and they'd gone into it, climbed under a bed to rescue this little kitten, and got it out before it collapsed. And on the way up to us, they found another cat on our staircase, so they rescued that. They didn't have enough bags, carry cases, so they just kind of stuffed it in a backpack to get it out of there. And they came in, got Mouse, and so they've taken him back into their care for now, so he's safe. And that was such a relief to us, because we didn't want to leave the apartment knowing that he might have survived and that he'd be out there somewhere. So it was such a kind of relief. After that, I just kind of felt like, okay, whatever amongst this of our possessions we can save is fine. What, you know, we can replace those. As long as the cat's all right.
Yeah. No. Well, it's another example of the enormous kindness and compassion of people there, isn't it?
Mm.
Not only people bringing food and water to survivors and etc., but also helping people reunited with their furry family.
Yeah.
To sort of put it in a bit of context, Chris, because I'm aware that some people might not be fully aware of the situation. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Lebanon was already in a financial crisis, which had obviously been made by the coronavirus. My understanding is, the in terms of the background, that it's the worst economic crisis since the 1975 Civil War. So there'd already been power cuts, as you mentioned, some lack of safe drinking water and limited public health care. So, that made it, when I sort of really realised that made it particularly sort of horrific, because you'd already got businesses shutting and goods, basic goods, expenses, etc. And I know that recently there'd been, on the Saturday, I believe, on the 8th, there'd been a lot of protests, including some people storming government buildings and stuff. Were you aware of those protests as well? And do you know anyone that was involved in that? Or?
What's interesting, actually, is that this is what, when we first arrived in Beirut in October, we were already aware that there was an economic crisis. Obviously, without going into too much history, Lebanon has since the civil wars there's always been lots of issues, still lots of problems with the country. And when you talk to people about the problems now, they're like, no, it's not, we're not suddenly in an economic crisis. This is 30 years in the making.
Yes, yes.
And when we arrived, there was the more obvious economic crisis, if you like, was beginning, or had begun. And within maybe a week of us being here, the October protests started, the revolution, or the Thawra, as it is in Arabic. And there were huge, like enormous protests in the street. And we went to twice, I think we went. Once was the really, really big Saturday protest.
Yeah.
And what was incredible about that is that it felt like the whole country, we learned loads about the kind of politics and history and what was going on really quickly because we were there. But it felt like the whole country coming together, which is can be quite unusual in Lebanon, because the politics is quite sectarian. You know, different areas of the country tend to be different religions, different sects of religions. So this amazing thing was happening where everyone was coming out onto the streets to demand change. And it resulted in the government resigning and a new government being brought in. So there was some sense that maybe that could improve things. I mean, most people were still not satisfied with that, because they just felt like it was the old brigade bringing in new people, but really they were just the same old. And that after that, the what really hurt the economy is the exchange rate, which is basically for many years the Lebanese currency has been pegged at a set rate to the dollar.
Yes, yeah.
To the US dollar, but it's artificial. So it's not really, you know how like the pound, UK pound, for example, changes against all of the currencies depending on the value.
Yes.
And that's kind of its real value. The value of the Lebanese money is artificially set against the dollar. And it's basically over the period of a few months, it just completely drifted away from it and lost like 70 or 80% of its value. And that's what's really kind of crashed the economy. And as that was happening, coronavirus came.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrendous.
And everything shut down.
It's really horrendous. Yeah.
So that's the kind of backdrop against which...
A very interesting entry point for you and Gemma as well, to sort of almost walk straight into a revolution. To arrive straight into those protests is really amazing. Yeah, I read a little bit about, I mean, economics is a big and new learn for me, but I know that the talks with the International Monetary Fund stalled and the bailout conversation sort of stalled, and it just seems like blow after blow after blow. So I can understand the anger and the protests continuing. I saw yesterday that the United Nations said that the country needed $76 million for emergency and humanitarian aid, partly sort of rebuilding of infrastructure. And an awful lot of people here have been horrified at what's going on. So I know this is a kind of big question, but for people that are listening that are outside and that are looking at this, I wondered if you might be able to share, Chris, what you think, kind of where people might be able to donate if they're able to, what specific causes that you think, as somebody that's living there, are the best places to give to if you're able to donate?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert, obviously, but I think well, there's a couple of things I'd say. One is any Lebanese person will tell you, just make sure you're giving the money in a way that's not going to end up with the government, because they don't trust the government with the money.
Right.
So there's a number of NGOs and small campaigns doing really brilliant stuff. What I would say is it depends kind of where you're, you know, what's closest to your heart, really. So there's the Lebanese Red Cross, who actually pretty much provide the ambulance service in Lebanon. So they're doing a lot of the kind of like the medical and rescue work. They've set up kind of loads of tents and temporary kind of medical facilities in the area. So that's a kind of, they're quite a fairly big one, I guess. And then there's one called Impact Lebanon, who are, they're quite an interesting organization, because they don't necessarily normally have specific aims and objectives, but they're interested in good causes and things that are, that kind of empower the Lebanese people to fix issues and to make things better and to make the world better. So for them, this has happened, and currently they are now focused on, I think their main thing is trying to find shelter for people that need it, but they're also doing some medical and rescue stuff. For animal lovers, I would definitely suggest looking at Animals Lebanon. Obviously, you know, the humanitarian side of things comes first, and that's on a much bigger scale. But Animals Lebanon, you know, they're not going to be getting the same scale of funding from people for this. And they're working so hard. It's brilliant. So I would, if you're an animal lover, I would recommend looking at Animals Lebanon. But there's lots of other smaller ones. I can't remember the names of them all, to be honest. But there's I know the Guardian did a little article where they listed a few with some explanations of exactly what they do. Because I think that's, you know, often you see like a disaster in another country, and there's that sort of one big humanitarian appeal, and you just put your money into it, and it's not very specific. But here there's, you know, if you do a bit of research and find one that kind of speaks to you or that you think is important. I mean, anything helps, I guess.
No, it don't. I'll find the Guardian article as well. That's a really good tip, because I think it can be a little bit overwhelming. And like you said, I think there's a little bit of sort of, is this, with every appeal now, there's like, is my money, as much as I'm able to give, going to get to people? So I think it's really great to sort of, it's great that anybody is compiling a list and sort of helping people know where to direct their financial aid. If they can do that, is sort of really helpful. So thank you for that, and I'll make sure I find that. You've mentioned and spoken and written beautifully, Chris, about the kindness that you've witnessed and the generosity and the people walking through rubble, you know, to help people and animals. And I wondered if you sort of inside Beirut and in Lebanon, what you think, well, what needs to be done next? And if it doesn't sound too audacious to speak about it, if you see, you and Gemma feel any hope or optimism for the future of Lebanon. I mean, it sounds to me that the people are amazing. The people are amazing, yeah. and they're taking care of each other. So, because I'm trying to, I suppose, in a realistic way, not in a sort of Pollyanna-ish way, but sort of think, okay, where's the hope here? Because I feel like hope encourages people to take action in a way that despair can make you just feel like it's not even worth trying. If you've found or can identify any sort of hopefulness in the midst of all of this?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I've talked about like the how kind people are and how people have come together to help people within the affected areas. But I think there's something, both in October when the revolution started, and in a way it continued going, and this is just an extension of it. But the protests on Saturday show that, you know, even though Lebanon is, you know, is quite a sectarian society, and there's so many people with lots of differences and so many scars from the civil wars, when the country comes together and when the people come together to demand something, they're so powerful, you know, that I remember in October standing in the middle of Martyrs Square amongst those amongst the revolution, amongst the protesters, and hearing them sing and chant, and every single person waving the Lebanese flag, which is unusual because, you know, you go to lots of different areas, whether it's a Christian area, whether it's, you know, Hezbollah area, they have their own flags and their own identity. But in that revolution, there were only Lebanese flags. Everybody was one and speaking with one voice and demanding change. And I think Saturday, that we weren't there on Saturday, but I think it's become even stronger. And if they can remain unified as a people, that shows real hope to me, because I think there can be change. And there's a you know, without getting in too much into politics, there's a cabinet meeting today, and the Prime Minister Diab has basically talked some of his cabinet members into holding off their resignations until this meeting today. But there's a lot of talk that they might still resign, and if enough of them go, the government will have to fully resign. And now, this is, when it happened before, you know, they just got replaced, but this time the whole world is watching, and that kind of that united people has got the eyes of the world and the support of the world. And you know, you've got Macron was here a few days ago, and he spoke yesterday about the need for the people to be listened to and for their demands to be met and for change to be made. And I think that it's possible, but it's, you know, it's still undecided. And, you know, I just hope that things can change and that people can be unified, and that the you know, the country's got such a, as a tourist destination, it's amazing, you know, that they've got, that's their kind of their USP and their natural resource, in a way that, you know, their economy could really boom if it could be, you know, become a popular tourist destination. There's so much hope in the country and so much potential. I was just going to say, it's that change in, you know, in leadership and how the country's run, and reform, and just for people to be able to trust the politicians that run the country. That could, you know, that we could see a real change in Lebanon and something much more positive to come out of it. But, you know, if that happens, it's just unfortunate that the trigger for that has been something that was so catastrophic.
Yes, although it sort of honours the suffering if something positive does come of it. Yeah. At least there's that. Do you feel like, as far as you know, Chris, sorry to make you an expert in everything, but I just wondered if you're sort of, does it feel like, are you aware that there are people in the wings, so to speak, politicians or activists in the wings that would be able to fill the gaps left by a government that isn't working? Do people have, are there names?
Well, yeah, that's one of the difficult things.
Yeah.
Is that that's unclear. And I mean, it's really difficult for us to be experts in it, because we don't speak Arabic. So the only local news that we can get is the sort of English speaking news, which is often like really kind of simplified and not a lot of detail. But the revolution has never really had obvious leaders, in a way. There's lots of people that kind of organize and run and kind of get it going, and but you know, in terms of having a people at the kind of top of the revolution, in a, because it's such a people's revolution, and nobody led it, it was spontaneous. People just took to the streets. Nobody told them to. They just turned up with Lebanese flags, and it built and built and built. So it's a people's revolution. And I think it's been difficult for people to, the idea of having someone that leads that has been quite difficult. And also, you know, are they going to be Christian or Muslim or Druze? you know, that those difficulties of whoever that person is, other political parties or sects might have issues with that. And so that's a difficult thing. But I think that, you know, when the last government resigned and the new one was brought in, the idea was that they were independent of political parties. So they're not MPs. They're, you know, it's not like the UK where the Prime Minister chooses their cabinet from MPs. It's the Prime Minister, I think, chooses. Actually, I think some different parties from Parliament is quite difficult to get your head around. Choose different candidates for different roles to be ministers, but they're not MPs. So in theory, they're independent because they're not from a political party, but they weren't really. They were put in by different political parties. So it's like, what happens if this government goes, you know, how do you bring in a truly independent government that are genuinely experts in their field? Because that's one of the things that's demanded, is a technocratic government. People that are, so your economy minister is an economist, is an expert, and has really good experience in that field, rather than, you know, well, I guess most governments, I mean, in the UK, often the cabinet positions are not filled by people that have any experience in those careers. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it'd be really interesting. Yeah. For you and Lebanese peoples to see what happens next, and as you said, hopefully it's helpful that, as you said, the world's eyes are on the situation, because sometimes scrutiny and social media are really helpful, actually. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And Chris, for yourself, for you and Gemma. What have you made decisions about? What's next, and what you're going to do? Because you're in. So I should explain as well that you were very, very generous and gracious in talking to me immediately after moving into your temporary new accommodation, which is lovely of you. But so what's your situation now, and what do you think you might do next?
Yeah, I mean. As I said, we're very much the lucky ones, really. We survived. We weren't injured. We've lost a lot of stuff, but, you know, a lot of it's insured. Hopefully we'll get that back. But, you know, the main thing for us was that the apartment that we'd lived in for, I think, 9 or 10 months was destroyed, really. And that was our home. You know, we'd bought bits and pieces for it to make it homely, and we were settled there, and, you know, our stay here was only ever going to be temporary, because we're here on tourist visas. You know, we're not on permanent visas or anything. So it was always going to be temporary. We were probably going to come back in February. So come back to the UK in February. So, you know, we decided that to say in 6 months we would be leaving anyway, to find a new apartment and to kind of, you know, that for the time it takes to make that feel like home. And we kind of felt like now is a good time to kind of call it a day and leave Lebanon, which we're really sad about. But, you know, it was always going to be temporary. So we're going to stay for one more week, which gives us time to see people and, you know, say goodbyes and tie up loose ends and things like that. And then come back to the UK for the short term, at least. We're sort of, you know, we don't quite know what we want to do next, but
no, I mean, you must still be, both of you must still be in shock. Of course, I mean, it's almost incomprehensible to me to have experienced that, and it's I don't know, it's quite good to not make too many big decisions, is it? It's just like, just keep things.
I mean, we said straight away, let's take 2 or 3 days to decide whether we stay or leave, and then we've kind of said, let's finish here, let's go back to the UK, and then and then let's think about what we want to do next, you know.
And how are your friends there? Have you managed to sort of catch up with friends and colleagues there and just sort of check in on them? Has that been possible? Or...
Yeah. I mean, it's like so a lot of people that we know here live outside of the kind of immediate kind of blast zone. Which is really nice, because then they've, you know, straight away, when we first came out of the apartment after getting our essential stuff, we suddenly stood in the road and it was dark, and we were like, we have no idea where we're going. We just rushed to get stuff and get out, and we had nowhere to stay. And then we looked at our phones and we had all these messages from friends that live here saying, do you need to come and stay with us? So that's been really nice, and to spend time with them, and they've been so kind and looked after us, and everybody that we know here has maybe been affected in some way, but is safe. So
good. I'm so glad to hear that, Chris.
It's good.
And if you just end on a sort of kind of little uptick, I wondered if you were to. So let's imagine you've come back home, and then you go back to you return to Beirut, let's say in a year's time, for what it's worth. If you, what would your hopes be on your return? If you could wave your magic wand and in a year's time revisit Beirut, what would you like to see, and how would you like it to be?
I mean, I hope that they can rebuild. The area where we lived, I hope they can rebuild that, because it was a real, had a really nice community feeling. I mean, it's funny, because it was like, there was quite a lot of expats lived there. It wasn't like an expat area, you know, it wasn't just like all British people or anything. There was lots of Lebanese people, but it was really popular with young people, basically, because there were lots of bars, there were lots of restaurants. You know, on a Friday and Saturday night, the road would be absolutely packed, with people kind of just standing in the street, drinking, buying drinks from whichever bar, just like a real kind of community feel to it. And we'd go in, because it was our kind of local area, we'd go in bars and the staff would know us. And the idea that that is gone is really upsetting, because it's a community that's gone. It's not just buildings and belongings.
No.
And it's really sad to see that, in a way. And I guess if we could come back in a year and it was rebuilt, and this, you know, the same people are there, and that same sense of the kind of, you know, because it's a chaotic street, you know, there's cars and horns and there's people everywhere, and which we love, you know, it really, that's what Beirut feels like to us. And I'd love to see that still there, because even before the explosion, there was a sadness in Beirut because of the economic crisis, and there was a sadness, and it had lost some of that kind of joy and carefree feeling that it had for us. I want to see that.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see Lebanese people happy again, you know, because it's sad to have seen that decline.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, let's hope, you know. I think it sounds like with the spirit and the generosity and the kindness of the people that are there, and like you said, with everybody watching and with the support of agencies and international aid as well, we can make that happen. So thank you so much for your time, Chris. I'll make sure that in the copy for the podcast there's as much information as possible, because I know loads of people are absolutely desperate and willing to help and are really keeping their eye on it, so that's a good thing.
I'd encourage people to just because my knowledge of Lebanese politics and things and news is not amazing. And I'm, you know, I may have been saying things that are slightly incorrect.
Yeah, no, sorry. I really put you on the spot with that. Sorry.
there might be Lebanese people listening thinking, what on earth is he talking about? But I'd advise, you know, go and read. It gets some coverage in the UK, but if you can look towards like Arab news sources, I think there is one, there's fairly good, I think it might just be called Arab News or something, or Al Jazeera, some of those news outlets that are kind of cover the Middle East, you'll get a better sense of what's going on than from me waffling about it.
Well, there's hope there, isn't there? And I think we've all had a real, during COVID, in response to Black Lives Matters and other things, have been like, come on, let's educate ourselves, let's connect, let's try and get our information from more than one source, let's be humble about what we don't know, but embrace the finding out, because actually it's really interesting to find out, and encouraging and empowering. So I think that's brilliant to be reminded that we can't know everything, but we can find it. So sorry to try and make you in an expert, but at the same time, it's really great to hear you talk about your actual on the ground experience of what that's like. I think it's really important to hear that story. So thank you so much for your time, Chris. When you're back, it would be my great honour to get you in at Gemma a great big drink or dinner or whatever you fancy.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah, so look forward to having you both back. And be safe. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, lovely. Lots of love.
It's a pleasure. All right.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye. Speak to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening. All the information about charities and organisations to support in order to support the recovery of Beirut and Lebanon, plus any information to other news sources, is in the copy for the podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and look forward to joining you next time. Thanks, bye.